key of the worshiper. Where's all of my praise? I want everybody around the world to put your hands together, because all the praise belongs to God. Here we go.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Today, we're going to be showing you what's good about cassava. It's a root vegetable common in the Caribbean and South and Central America, rarely consumed here, rarely found here, unless it's at specific markets, indigenous markets. Something very good about it, I'll be telling you about it, along with about 14 other health stories, all new, you haven't heard about them, all cutting edge, all meant to allow you to live a happier and healthier life. Then I'm going to go to our phones, and I don't know how many calls I can take. It depends upon the question that a person is asking and how complete the answer needs to be. But we're going to continue with that, and it's going very well, by the way. Our voicemail line, so you can call in anytime, day or night, 24/7, leave a message. 862-800-6805. 862-800-6805. But if you want to listen to this live, by all means, we have a number. Anywhere in Canada, the United States, most of Mexico. 641-793-7091. 641-793-7091. But we always start with health and healing, and I'll also be completing my vaccine and showing and proving that it can cause neurological brain damage, including autism. From the Danforth Plant Science Center, a new study showing that cassava is high in iron and zinc and could improve the diets and health in West Africa. Now, this is a field-grown cassava plant, and it is rich in the genes that can have significant concentrations of good nutrients in us. But most people consider things like millet, which is very common in West Africa, as a poor man's protein. Forget a poor man's protein, it's very high quality protein, just like quinoa. So quinoa and cassava root and amaranth, these are all good sources. Animal proteins are not. They're good as far as protein, but there's too much protein and they lack fiber and they lack other nutrients like that the body needs. They lack antioxidants, and these have antioxidants. So one way to help overcome micronutrient deficiencies, which is a global threat to human health, and is particularly severe in Africa. In fact, in Nigeria, 75% of preschool children and 67% of pregnant women are anemic, and 20% of children below 5 years of age suffer from zinc deficiency. And iron deficiency anemia affects the immune system and stunts growth and impairs cognition in development in children. So there's no reason why, with the high rates of anemia, that they can't overcome this. And the cassava root is one way of overcoming it and helping stopping stunting of growth and reduce cognitive development. It's that simple. And the paper was published in the peer-reviewed journal Nature Biotechnology. Next up, not all saturated fats are equal when it comes to heart health. This is from Dordrecht University in the Netherlands, and it was published in the International Journal of Cardiology. And what it comes down to is simple. The type of saturated fats we eat can affect our risks of heart disease, including heart attacks. People whose diets contain relatively little palmitic and stearic acids, which are saturated fats, and they're composed of 16 or more carbon atoms, that these are the long-chain saturated fats. And those are typically found in the American diet. Meats, loaded with them, as well as arachidonic acids. Those are not good. But If you eat a plant-based diet and get your proteins that way, you actually decrease your chances of myocardial infarction. You have a substantial lower risk of having a heart attack or stroke. Moreover, individuals who eat more saturated fats with 14 or fewer carbon atoms, that's the shorter chain saturated fats that are typically found in dairy products, have lower risks of myocardial infarction. So the analysis of diets of large groups of individuals in two countries over time shows the type of saturated fats you consume could affect a cardiovascular health. That's important. The one fat that is saturated that is the healthiest of all saturated fats, coconuts, coconut oil. That's the best of the best. So, and in countries around the world, especially in the South Pacific, and also in some Indonesian countries and Polynesian countries, you will find that where they use a lot of palm oil and eat palm, eat coconut, not the palm, but the coconut oil, they have lower incidence of cardiovascular disease. Also, from Iowa State University, what you eat, now they're saying, can impact your brain and memory. We've known this for a long time. I did a special that appeared on PBS stations called The Food-Mood Connection. And a whole panel of physicians, for those of you who saw it, all said the same thing. In fact, I had several neurologists and psychiatrists that for those who were having depression and anxiety disorders, when they started shifting to a plant-based diet, they found that the people's memory improved substantially. And I'd written a book on the subject. It's out of print now, but it was a very popular bestseller at one time, about 30 years ago. So here's what it comes down to. You've all heard the saying, you are what you eat, and that is correct. But within what you eat, it also impacts your memory. A professor and a team of researchers at Iowa State University's Department of Food Science and Human Nutrition discovered a satiety hormone at higher levels could decrease a person's likelihood of developing Alzheimer's disease. The paper is published in Neurobiology of Aging. In using data from the Alzheimer's Disease Neuroimaging Initiative, the researchers looked at the satiety hormone. Satiety means staying. It means once you have a certain satiety, and historically this was done with food, you wouldn't be hungry. And that was the entire principle spoken directly to me by my friend Bob Atkins. And he was correct when he said that if you eat meat or pork or cheese, fish, chicken, that you will have no appetite for a period of time until that digests. And therefore, that will be the time most people start snacking, and those snacks are generally unhealthy. They're sugar-laden, refined carbohydrate, and it's pulling extra calories into the system. He was correct, but here's what was left out of the equation. Had he suggested almonds, cashews, pecans, peanuts, which is actually a legume, not a nut, avocados, any number of other foods that are slow digesting, low glycemic foods, it would have created the same phenomena. Satiety, without all the harmful effects that the meat products and the saturated fat bring. So, if you want to have a better memory, if you want to improve your brain, a healthy plant-based diet will do it. And that's important. Also, from the University of Warwick comes a study that shows training your brain to form good habits is through repetition. I don't think we needed a study from university to prove this. I think through time immemorial, people have known that children mimic their parents. Animals, little cats and dogs, mimic the parent. That's how they're trained. That's how they're learning to survive. So you can hack your brain to form good habits, like going to a gym and eating healthy, simply by repeating the actions until they stick. That is what matters. And that's what a Dr. Elliot Ludwig from the Warwick Department of Psychology with colleagues at Princeton and Brown Universities have created a model which shows that forming good, or for that matter bad habits, depends more on how often you perform an action than on how much satisfaction you get from it. This was published in the current issue of Psychology Review. So let me bring this down to its most basic element. If you wake up in the morning and you put it on your schedule, I must do some exercise. Now, of course, depending upon the weather and other variables, it can be indoors or outdoors. And depending upon your age and circumstances, it may be in a gym or maybe sit-ups, push-up, resistance exercise, squats, whatever you're able to do. But if you say, I'm going to do this every day, and you make sure you do it every day, and you have a check-off list, okay, I got up and made myself a glass of herbal tea, or I made myself a smoothie, or I made myself a fresh juice, or I drank a glass of, you know, vegetable juice. If you do it every day, at a certain point, and it's different for every person, it becomes automatic. A good habit or a bad habit is from repetition. And that's why living in the moment and being mindful of the power of a good habit can make all the difference in the world for your health. And so that's why working on repetitive good things is important. And also from the University of Waterloo, which is Ontario, in a test of wisdom, new research favors Yoda over Spock. A person's ability to reason wisely about a challenging situation may improve when they also experience diverse yet balanced emotions. The finding clarifies millennia of philosophical and psychological thinking that debates how wisdom is related to the effective management of emotional charged experiences. Wise reasoning does not necessarily require uniform emotional control or suppression, and that's important. Instead, wise reasoning can also benefit from a rich and balanced emotional life. And characteristics of wise reasoning would be, for example, having a sense of self-confidence but balanced with humility. If you're confident you can do something, and if you're confident you can do it well, or at least to the best of your ability, that self-confidence is a motivating and impassioning essential no matter what you're trying to do. Now, as you succeed, you bring in humility so that you're able to do something and do it well, but you needn't brag about it. You needn't make yourself the center of the universe. You needn't constantly refer to what you're doing as if it was better than anyone else. You simply say, I'm happy with my progress. I'm doing good. And you just keep at that. That balance, also the ability to express multiple emotions at the same time, influences one's ability for wise reasoning. You can be, in fact, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to take a break. I'm going to answer some questions. Then I'm going to play you a clip that I just watched this morning. I was going to save it, but this will give you an idea of what I'm talking about, how you have to be able to balance multiple emotions, what we would call emote diversity, the ability to experience multiple yet evenly balanced emotions. And they point out that past research indicated that emote diversity could reduce clinical psychopathology symptoms by preventing any one emotion from dominating a person's experience. Because what happens, we get you've heard me use the term monotheistic, meaning single-focused. And when we think only of one thing, we frequently only feel one thing. And that gets us into trouble. We should be able to balance multiple emotions simultaneously. And I'll show you how that works and also address one of the previous callers from last week who talked about doom and gloom. That's what she feels. And I'll explain how to deal with that when you're faced with what looks like insurmountable objects and you feel helpless to address them. We're going to take a break and come back with your questions. Please stay with us.
Yes, Gary, this is Leroy again. I wanted to know what your opinion is of Schultz, the former CEO of Starbucks, and have you done enough research on him yet? He's thinking about running for president of the United States.
I'm not aware of a single candidate that I would support from either party. They're all grossly deficient. He will be running as an independent, which means that the Democrats are threatening to boycott Starbucks if he runs because they are afraid that he would split the ticket. He is your typical Clinton neoliberal. I have no respect for Howard Schultz. And why? Okay, Starbucks is one of the most formidable corporations in the world. 92% of Starbucks coffee is not fair trade. Farmers in Ethiopia are being paid only 57 cents a pound for Ethiopian Sodoma coffee, a mere 2.2% of the projected retail price. They do all the work. They have the initial investment. It's their labor and time, and they're paid slave labor. So look at most of these coffee producers. The low prices paid to coffee farmers by Starbucks forces children to work on their family farms, with an alarming, the latest figure I was told was 2 million children in Sodoma area alone, working an average of almost 30 hours a week. Not sustainable are the cups. We forget about the cups. They cannot be recycled. The extensive manufacturing process during the assembly of Starbucks coffee cups require 90% new paper to be produced. And paper, where does it come from? It comes from trees and then turned to wood chips in a machine rather than using recycled paper fibers. And due to the plastic lamination lining, Starbucks cups are unable to be recycled and will therefore end up in a landfill. And for a company producing a mind-boggling 2 billion cups per year, and only 18% of Starbucks stores containing recycling facilities. And he's still buying palm oil and other agricultural products that might be linked to tropical forest destruction. And I consider all palm oil irresponsible. In fact, in Southeast Asia, they routinely destroy tropical forest and peatlands for plantations, in the process producing fires that emit tons of carbon pollution, threatening the health of area residents and endangering elephants and orangutans and tigers. And also, it's been associated with large-scale land grabs from local communities and indigenous peoples, as well as egregious labor rights abuses, including forced labor, child labor, and illegal exploitation of migrant workers. And so it's terrible. And also, there was a big movement to prevent unionization. In fact, the National Labor Relations Board has repeatedly found them guilty of illegally terminating, harassing, or intimidating and discriminating dozens of violations in just a few New York stores. And also, I remember, I think it was in the Huffington Post, about the refusing to guarantee workers' hours, but forces them to keep themselves available 70% of open store hours just to qualify as full-time. And workers rescued from Brazil coffee plantation that supplied Starbucks, where they were working under degrading conditions and living in substandard housing without sewage without drinking water. And they used 140 million gallons of milk a year. That's just obscene, because they have never shown you a video, and I've actually done one, showing you how dairy cows and dairy calves are treated and slaughtered and abused. So you put it all together, and I have zero respect for Howard Schultz. I would never go into a Starbucks, and nor do I appreciate the lack of, listen carefully, intentional neglect, which leads to intentional ignorance. One begets the other. So you can say, I didn't know. And I would say, do you care to know? And you'd say, it depends upon how it's going to impact me. And I would say, I don't really care how it impacts you as much as I care how it impacts the people who are working at slave labor, animals being tortured and killed, so you can have your damn cup of coffee. They'll say, but it's my choice. I'll say, I absolutely agree. It's your choice. And it's also your choice to stay this dumb about important issues. But you're a good Democrat today. You're a Clinton Democrat or Obama Democrat, like we need another one of those. So are you caring at all about what would happen if another Obama, another Clinton became president, and that's Howard Schultz? In fact, all of the lead ones are just trying to emulate Obama. And before you think that Obama was the best president because he was charming, he was, and had a good sense of humor, he did, and was good on his feet, he could do that. Look at all the people who are dead, the women and children who have been bombed, droned, raped, beaten, tortured. Look at the women and children in Yemen. That's Obama's war. It was under him where he had a $100 billion contract with Saudi Arabia. Look at Clinton. She was the one who celebrated in a party right on New Year's Eve when that biggest military contract in history ever went through with Saudi Arabia. Look at the people in Northern Africa, in Libya. Look at the organs being taken from people who want to migrate out and sold. Look at the slave markets. But we're not going to do that, are we? We're not going to get that close to the truth. That would scare the hell out of us. Hope that tells you what I think of Howard Schultz and all of the Democrats and all the Republicans who are running for office. We'll take another call.
Hi, Gary. I'm calling from South Central Alaska on the Kenai Peninsula. My question has to do with our organic vegetables at the grocery. Vegetables look good, but looking good doesn't last long. The vegetables and fruits are tasteless. Some come in plastic, so one can't pick and choose. Don't get me wrong. We just had a hydroponic farm open, but that's just limited to salad greens. My question is, what can be done to fortify these greens? Is organic frozen an option? Just don't think I'm getting full nutrition out of these plants. Thanks a lot.
First of all, thank you for listening up in Alaska. You're going to be getting things that have to be shipped to you, and depending upon the time of year, they might be shipped from Florida or from Mexico, from Argentina, or from California. Almost never are you going to get anything that's that fresh. You have to look at the timeline. When farmers pick something, they can't pick it when it's ripe if it's going to be shipped, because then it will be overripe and start getting bruises, mushiness, by the time it gets into the store. So more often than not, they will take an item, and it won't be tree-ripened. It won't be ripened on the vine. Instead, it might even be green. And then they allow it to ripen slowly, because the moment you put anything into a refrigeration, it slows down all ripening. That's why an avocado won't ripen, a peach won't ripen. Once it's refrigerated, it stops its maturation. That means it's tasteless and frequently pithy tasting, because it didn't have that maturity. The answer is twofold. First, expand on the hydroponics. If they have microgreens, that's because they can grow very fast. Sprouts can grow within a week, microgreens in about 20 days, and there's at least 50 different microgreens. But mind you, a microgreen can grow into a full vegetable also. It's just that you get far more nutrition and far more antioxidant auric factor in the smaller variety. But you can grow tomatoes to full out, complete ripeness on the vine in organic hydroponics. And then if you want to supplement beyond that, then if just take in the morning, take a teaspoon of chlorella, and which is a sea algae, and drink that down. That covers a full spectrum of nutrients that you might not be getting as completely as you would like to. Okay? We'll take another call.
Yeah, this is PRN FM. I would like to leave a message for Gary Noll's show. I was wondering what you thought about Mexico and Guatemala to retire to. Maybe even just part of a year. What do you think about that? Do you think that you could, like, your answers, put them in kind of index file on on your site so that, you know, if you don't listen to all the shows, you know, you don't hear the answer. Thank you very much.
I'll address the second part of your question first. Right now, we are cataloging every program I've ever done in my career. That's a lot of shows. That's tens of thousands. And we're cross-referencing it by topic and by guest by topic. So you'll be able to go in the future when we get this done, because it's not a fast process. And you'll be able to find out everything on cancer from every show I've ever done with anyone on cancer in my entire history. This is a very comprehensive project, but we're in the process of doing it. I do not have any method at this moment to cut out just that segment, but I will ask Jesse and our other engineers and Glenn if they have a way to excise just the answering the questions out and post it for example, by date. That way you could at least look to see if I've answered your question. So we'll put that in the hopper. More importantly is that a lot of people are looking at where else in this world could they go except the United States for semi-retirement or permanent retirement. And of course, because the weather is much nicer in the Dominican Republic or other places than it is in the United States right now, at least think about where you're living. If you're living in the Midwest, you're in an Arctic vortex, and this is the beginning of the new normal. Minus 40 to 50 degrees below zero. You're going to see thousands and thousands of animals die, frozen to death, and probably, unfortunately, some people, including homeless people, that didn't make it into the shelters. I would not recommend either the Dominican Republic. I wouldn't recommend any place right now, even people like a place like Belize and Costa Rica, that historically had been wonderful places, beautiful places, nice people. And it's not the people that you have to worry about, nor is it the environment. It's narco-terrorists. I can't tell you how many times I've told friends, one I'm thinking of right now, who went down to Costa Rica, and next thing you know, he was, and he'd been down there for some time, and someone approached him. Well, I won't tell you his story because I don't want to make it so anyone could identify him. I'll just tell you what it's called. It's called the 10 percenters. Here's how it works. You have your retirement house. It may not be much, but it's nice. And in Panama or someplace. Next thing you know, a guy comes, knocks on your door. He's a lawyer, and he's going to give you a check for your house or your apartment or your land, whatever he wants to buy from you. And all the paperwork is there, but what's not there is the actual value of the property. You're only getting a percentage of the property value. And you say, well, I don't want to sell. My life savings are here. And he says, well, today I'm going to give you silver. Tomorrow you're going to get lead. Right now, you have an opportunity. Tomorrow you won't. These people don't bluff. any place you think you can go and get help, they've already bought these people out. Judges, state attorney general. In fact, just an attorney general in Mexico was just arrested for accepting $1 million from Guzman Chapo for protection. Organized crime has bought everything and everyone. And what they're doing with these homes, they're using them as safe homes or homes that they can then turn a big profit on. And it's everywhere. I mean, everywhere. Let me repeat that. You can't find a place where you're not, there's not the possibility of you being victimized. Now, if you're under the radar and no one knows anything about you, that's fine. That's the way it used to be. Oh, I don't have a big place. I'm not a rich person. You know, who cares about me? But now they have what are called the 10 percenters. And the 10 percenters are people who work in travel agencies, because when you go into any country, you have to give your date of birth, your all your information, including your passport. From that date of birth and your information, they can get up all your credit history, and suddenly you may not be worth a lot of money. Maybe your father's a lawyer or a doctor, in which case you are worth money because there's going to be a ransom when they kidnap you. They're so good that if they think you're of value and you pull into a Mexico airport, you go outside to get a cab, and there are 20 cabs. Every one of those 20 cabs will have a picture of you, and whoever cab you get into, they won't take you where you're going. They'll take you to a safe house, and then the negotiations start for your release. Much of this is completely unstated because they say if word gets out, then we have people in the police departments, in which case then one of your family members in the United States will be killed. So the actual number of kidnappings, the actual number of monies paid, no one knows. But the people who were setting the whole process up get 10% from the people who finally get the money. That is rampant. It's epidemic. Now, 250,000 people minimally have been killed in the last 10 years in Mexico alone. Just a couple weeks ago, 7 were killed in one day in a tourist resort. So you think you're safe? Think again. If you want a place to go to, go to a place where you have a chance of having quality life with wonderful people, a nice environment, and that would be Ireland, Southern Ireland, around Cork. That's a great place. Love the people. There's Spain is good. Portugal is great. Even the Canary Islands. There are places. I would never go to Eastern Europe. I don't care what kind of deal. Hungary, Poland, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Lithuania. Now, it doesn't mean there's not nice people. There are nice. The vast majority of people wherever I travel in the world are nice. But organized crime, one person with a gun has more power than 1,000 people standing in front of him who are unarmed. And he's only got 6 bullets. And you're thinking, I don't want to be one of those 6 bullets victim. So crime is everywhere. Graft is everywhere. Corruption is everywhere. It's endemic. In Costa Rica, my God, when I was in Costa Rica, and I was there with one of my buddies who lived in the capital, and as we're going down the street dodging potholes, repeatedly we were stopped. Guy puts a rifle in the window, and my buddy just pushes the, you know, rifle away and says, go on, keep driving. And I'm thinking, you know, this guy could have shot us. He says, no, they just want money. I said, well, what happens to the guy that decides he wants to make an example? No. And I said, man, you're living in the wrong place. People nice, beautiful environment, and crime rules. So just be aware of that. Don't believe what the tourist guides tell you, the travel agents. They have a financial interest in getting you to go their direction. Okay? That's all the time we have for calls today. I'll take more tomorrow. We're going to take a break and come back, and I'm going to, now let me see. Yes, we're going to go to a clip, and I'm going to notify the people in New York. We're going to go to a clip that I gave Jesse this morning about what happens when a group of the world's really very insightful environmentalists and climatologists and scientists start taking a look at this soul-crushing climate despair that a woman was talking about. We're going to come back with that next.
Feel. For years now, their research has returned data that points to a looming global climate crisis. And despite an overwhelming consensus among the world's experts, there are still those that deny it's even happening. How do they keep on keeping on? Well, let's find out. Do you see in scientists and researchers, you know, the various stages of grief?
I do, but they aren't likely to bring it up to me. Typically, people will focus on what they're doing, what they have found in their research. And if I push a little bit, they'll talk about what their anxieties are. But people who are involved in this arena, who are working, tend to use as a coping mechanism that focus on the work that they're doing. And that's really good because their work is important.
It actually was about 4 or 5 years ago. There was a climate scientist in Scandinavia named Jason Box. And again, going back to that Esquire piece I talked about earlier, he put the following tweet out. He said, if even a small fraction of Arctic seafloor carbon is released to the atmosphere, we're effed. Michael, what's the best way to communicate science to the public, in your view, with that kind of brutal honesty, or maybe with some restraint and optimism, even if you don't truly feel it?
It's not binary. It's not effed or not effed. It's a matter of how effed. That is left for us to determine. And I'll tear up, especially when I'm talking to an audience of young people, because, you know, what a terrible injustice we've done them, or we've allowed others to do them, by misleading them on what is arguably the greatest challenge we face as a civilization. I know that we can still avert catastrophic climate change. Too often we encounter individuals who are convinced that there's nothing we can do, that we've gone past some, you know, tipping point. There are individuals who have made a name for themselves by arguing that we will be extinct in 10 years because of exponential climate change, whatever that means, and there's nothing that we can do about it. And that's simply wrong. It would be one thing if that were true.
Quit your job.
Yeah, well, you know, it's already happening. It's already happening. And can we project forward with certainty that what is happening now is going to be exacerbated into the future? Of course we can. If only for one simple reason, that the maximum heating associated with carbon dioxide lags behind the release of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere by about 10 years. So we know that 10 years from now is going to be hotter than today.
As a scientist, I understand the science. I understand the projections. I know what the uncertainties are and what the limitations are. And that actually, once again, is empowering because I know that we can still avert catastrophic climate change.
Never mind the methane that is exploding out of the Arctic Ocean and out of the permafrost. Never mind the virtually immediate self-reinforcing feedback loop that is the water vapor in the upper troposphere. You know, you start stacking these things together and it looks like a really dire future. It does not look like a continued relatively slow rate of change like we have seen since 1750 or even 1850 or even 1900. It looks like we're going to achieve much higher temperatures on Earth, global average temperature, in a very short period of time than we've ever seen before. And so, of course, that's going to interrupt habitat for trout. And of course, that's going to interrupt habitat for grizzly. And of course, it's going to interfere with habitat for the jays and the white-barked pine. How could it not?
Yeah. Here's scientist Camille Parmesan, who shared the Nobel Prize with Al Gore in 2007, saying that she became, quote, professionally depressed studying climate change. Another climate journalist, Eric Holthaus, wrote in 2018, I lose sleep over climate change almost every single night. I can't remember how long this has been happening, but it's been quite a while, and it's only getting worse. I confess I need help. He went to counseling for what he called his soul-crushing climate despair. And one more. Activist Jillian Caldwell, who wrote, "I believe that I and many other people around the world are suffering from, quote, climate trauma. It's my own term. I am not a mental health professional, but I can identify plain as day the symptoms I recognize in myself and in my colleagues traumatized by our work to tackle climate change." Okay, Lisa, please get us started on this. Let's start with a mental health professional. How would you characterize what some scientists and activists are saying that they're experiencing?
It's clear that they're responding emotionally to what is a very legitimate condition. And that is that the climate is crashing and we have enormous consequences. So for them not to be experiencing these kinds of emotions would be odd. They would be out of touch with what they are actually surrounded by. So entirely legitimate in my mind.
Let's do a quick follow-up here. We've all heard of post-traumatic stress, but you have called this pre-traumatic stress. What does that mean?
Pre-traumatic stress is like post-traumatic stress disorder, except that you're experiencing these symptoms before the events happen. But, you know, even when I started using the term pre-traumatic stress, it was before we saw so many catastrophes. And now it's not even legitimate to call it pre-traumatic stress, except in the sense that people are imagining or conjuring even worse consequences down the road.
The winters are getting shorter, and they're getting shorter on both ends. The length of the seasons in the summer and the autumn is being extended, and the spring is more moving forward into the winter. So we're going to see the collapse of that wolverine habitat, that one little piece you mentioned that is absolutely required. It's required, but it's not necessary to maintain wolverine habitat. You got to have that one little piece, and you got to have a bunch of other pieces as well. You remove any one of those pieces along the way, wolverines are gone, period. It's not that they're gone that week, but once they lose that habitat, they're functionally extinct. And then what are you going to do? Put them in a zoo? You know, we did that with the passenger pigeon. We did that with the Carolina parakeet. We did it with a bunch of different species. But ultimately, they all went the same way. They don't have a habitat. Habitat out here. Habitat in the Northern Rockies. Habitat in Siberia. If they don't have habitat, they're functionally extinct, which means they're living on borrowed time.
You're so used to studying in terms of numbers and figures and graphs and equations that sometimes you lose sight of the reality and the real threat that climate change constitutes.
Well, as a social scientist, as someone who studies climate politics, I feel what Michael and Lisa are talking about all the time, and my students ask if I feel despair about climate change and global environmental problems, and I tell them it depends on the day.
What were you telling me before we started taping?
Yeah, and
what's the question they ask?
The question I ask at the beginning of all these classes that I teach is, you know, should we have this class or should we just go to the beach, right? And give up.
Right, and George Monbiot just had a piece up about this, about going vegan as a response to too much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And whereas it is true that about 30% of methane is produced by industrial agriculture, and a significant amount of carbon dioxide is produced by industrial agriculture as well. Sure, absolutely. It's too late.
Lisa, let me read something to you that was in The Guardian last October, just after the IPCC report came out. And here we go. This is Rebecca Solnit writing. "Taking action is the best way to live in conditions of crisis and violation for your spirit and your conscience, as well as for society. It's entirely compatible with grief and horror. You can work to elect climate heroes while being sad. There are no guarantees, but just as Soviet dissidents Sakharov and Sharansky probably didn't imagine that the Soviet Union would dissolve itself in the early 1990s, so we can anticipate that we don't exactly know what will happen and how our actions will help shape the future. Knowing that we don't know isn't grounds for confidence, but it is fuel against despair, which is a form of certainty. This future is as uncertain as it's ever been." What do we do with that, Lisa?
Well, she's right. There are those stages of grief and bargaining and anger and all the rest. And we need to take the energy of those emotions and turn it into action.
I don't know how many ways
I couldn't agree
to tell
more.
People that it's too late to change our diets. And furthermore, how are you going to convince 7.7 billion people to change their diets? How are you going to convince 7.7 billion people to not have children, to change their diet radically?
And
change
quit
their
eating
diets?
Your carne asada, Doug.
To me, this is just another example of large institutions, including the media, including a significant body of scientists, who are shaming and blaming people into changing their actions. Well, that doesn't work. We know that that doesn't work. Shaming and blaming people will not cause them to change their behavior. It works on a five-year-old.
And this is what we're talking about, this empowering action. With any situation, challenge that we're faced with, if we just are kicking it around and thinking about it and not doing anything about it, the anxiety sits there.
We're not five-year-olds. Treat us like adults. And furthermore, there's abundant evidence now indicating that going vegan, even if we all went back 70 years and went vegan then, it's still not going to save anything, certainly not including us.
And I want to underscore again that any time we are out talking to the public, any of us, or with our friends and relatives, the issue is what do we want to communicate? And one of the things that is so important...
Okay, that's just a small part of it. The full tape is up on PRN.fm. I look at it a little differently. I don't get depressed about it, nor do I get anxiety-ridden, as these people do, and I've spoken with them in person when I'm filming. Mind you, we had the most comprehensive film on the environment ever done, and you'll see it in the very near future. We're just wrapping up one more week of filming, and that's it. Then it's just post-production. We've been in post-production for over a year. You have climate scientists who know the truth, but fear for their careers or scaring the public by telling them. Then you have people who've had the courage, like Guy McPherson, you heard their professor of environmental sciences, Professor Emeritus of Environmental Science, who told the truth and suffered some severe attacks because of it. As if we weren't ready for that much truth. I believe that we should just tell the truth, but at the same time, encourage people to make changes. Can we reverse global warming? No. Is it too far? Yes. Are we going to have major cataclysmic events? Absolutely. Some are happening right now. I mean, if you live in over 9 states right now, starting tomorrow, you're going to be hitting the Arctic vortex at a temperature that you've never seen in the history of that state before. If you live in Australia, fruits are bursting because they've overheated on the inside with the hottest day in Australian recorded history yesterday. New Zealand is now in the same dynamic. And remember, Australia is about the same size as the United States, continental United States, and its drought is just devastating it. Australia's toast. And this is the new norm. Well, how do you adapt to that? You can bring in some desalinization plants, but then you're creating another form of pollution, which is contributing to the cycle. You have the major industrial powers that don't want to give up anything. They want to grow. They want more gross domestic product. China, India, and the United States, but also the European Union. Brazil, with this new completely dim-witted person who's the new president, he makes Mussolini look conservative, not radical fascist. And he is opening up the rainforest for complete profiteering. That means that the last saving grace of carbon sinks are going to be mowed down for genetically engineered soy, and then you're going to see a giant jump in global warming. So the reality is that we've passed the mark where we can reverse at least half of all the major tipping points. They are tipping, half tipped, can't untip them. That doesn't mean that the world ends. It doesn't mean we all die. It doesn't mean, like On the Beach, that movie with Fred Astaire, where, you know, everyone around is dying and they're just waiting to die, still looking for hope somewhere. We will have people who have the money who can shift where they're at. they can survive. But the average person, you have to be proactive. If you're an adaptive supportive, that isn't going to happen for most, unless you're on the very upside and aware and saying, I can move, I can find other work. So my suggestion is now, right now, that you start looking realistically at where are the places in this country, around the world, that can be sustainable. And then what tools do you need in order to make that move in a reasonable and conscious way? You shouldn't do anything out of panic. But we haven't even talked about what is going to exacerbate everything, and that is the collapse of the dollar as the reserve currency. And that, I believe, will happen within the next 5 years, which means that whatever you own is going to be worthless. And then we're going to see people going hungry in America. We're going to see the government step in with the full force of its military and its weaponized police, and you're going to see civil war in the United States. It's inevitable, especially with fascists in positions of power, and I consider almost all the people in Congress and the president, everyone else, fascistic in their attitude because they're neoliberal in their attitude, and one begets the other. So what I suggest is you just start looking at the reasonable things to do. I did a six-hour special, webinar about 3 months ago on what to do before disaster strikes. I suggest you go to GaryNull.com or PRN.FM and download it. So you can work on yourself. You can save yourself probably through much of your normal lifespan. But almost every scientist I speak with now, not a year ago, certainly not 10 years ago, says that anyone born today will not survive to old age. That still means that people can still have quality of life if they're smart. They're just places you shouldn't be, and because you're going to get hammered either by these vortexes or hurricanes, earthquakes, or volcanoes. Just get out of harm's way. And that's not some secret that's being, you know, held by people. There are lots of good places to live. There's lots of quality of life. There are intentional communities. And my suggestion is you start looking at intentional communities, because then you got the support of other people. You still maintain your autonomy, still maintain your own individuality, but you can share things that you wouldn't have the skills or the knowledge or insight, so other people work together cooperatively. It's a cooperative, not a commune, not a cult, cooperatives. They're all over the world. But unless you go looking for them, you're not going to find them. They wouldn't be in your normal day-to-day transactions. And environmental communities exist, intentional communities exist, cooperative communities exist, just like food co-ops. Think of how many people walk right by a food co-op, go to a Whole Foods, and pay far more for merchandise that's not as good as it would be in their food co-op. That's that intentional ignorance, breaking patterns. So at this point, I'm suggesting do not go into gloom and doom, because there's so many of the things you could do. There are countless numbers of options you have at this moment. Now ask yourself about what did you do when you were told Hurricane Sandy was coming? And that was a little hurricane that produced some big damage. What if it's Category 5? And are we going to get a Category 5 up and down the East Coast hitting some major cities? You bet. In fact, the people I'm speaking with and filming predict that we could have anywhere from 3 to 5 Category 4 or 5 hurricanes on a yearly basis. Well, then that's going to mean a lot of people are going to be moving or forced to move. If you're forced to move and you don't have the money, you don't have the resources, you haven't done your homework, you've stayed intentionally ignorant, thinking somehow it's not going to happen to me or it won't be so bad, then I can't help you. But I can provide a lot of resources to show you the good places to live that will still be good. But when they say, and these particular scientists, many were saying, you got 5 years before we start seeing cataclysmic events. Mind you, it's different to say we're going to see cataclysmic events versus the world ends. The world's not going to end. The world will never end. It's just that our ability to sustain quality of life and continue to exploit finite resources, contributing to the very plight that we're in, That will come to an awareness probably within 7 years. So it will be the number one topic on everyone's points of interest in 7 years. There'll be whole areas of the world, in Africa, South America, in northern altitudes, where there's no more trees, the devastation because of swinging between extreme hot summers and dry, and then extreme cold kills off the natural flora and fauna, kills trees, beetles, infestations, fires. So the places that we had grown up in that were quality of life are going to change. But not everything changes. There will be places to live. There'll be food if you know about how to grow food, how to store food. I'll bet many people in this audience in the next 5 years will be purchasing these freeze-dried machines that can store hundreds of pounds of food for up to 25 years. And so when times get bad, if where you live gets bad, you won't have to worry about where your next meal is coming from. So there are millions of people in the United States, I'm guesstimating around 7%, who are fully aware not just of the consequences, but are proactive in doing something about it. And if you can't do it yourself, you can go up on the Internet and look at all the groups that are working on environmental issues cooperatively. And that's why I don't feel that we should be in doom and gloom mood. Now, if you're a poor person in a country and you have no means of getting out of the country and there's no water, there's severe drought, and there's famine, yeah, those people are about a billion as we speak, a billion. And not a single thing, not one thing, are we doing in the United States to acknowledge that they're suffering and try to help them. So we're going to be doing more on this topic, not to scare people, just to get through so you pay attention and start to work together. We're out of time. Tonight, 7 o'clock, really dynamite show. Wow. We have some heavy-duty discussion going on tonight. We're going to talk about what's really happening in Venezuela. And we're going to have Professor William Robinson, professor in Latin American Studies, University of California, and Greg Pallast, one of our most important investigative journalists, for the full hour. We'll tell you the truth about all this tonight. Have a good day, everyone.